All right, we'll call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs, Finance to order. And first thing on the agenda will be approval of minutes. You should have two sets of minutes. One goes back to 2009. Representative Magnus moves the minutes from April 21st, 2009. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those are adopted. And Representative, who was here? Doty moves the minutes of January 13th, 2010. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, first of all, just a reintroduction, our pages. You two want to introduce yourself again, who you are, and where you came from, where you went to high school. We always like to know that. And how's your interest in agriculture? You told me before.
Yes, sir. I'm marrying a pork farmer and who lives in Owatonna, Minnesota.
Okay. She's marrying a hog farmer from Owatonna. Hey. All right. And the other familiar face.
I'm interested. I don't need any introduction. Hardly. I was born and raised on a farm and my grandfather's homestead in Orange County. Went to country school for a while. Worked for public utility for 38 years and needed something to do to get out of the house. And my wife liked that. So this is my ninth year, I guess, and she's got to put up with me another year.
Very good. We appreciate both of you being here. Hope we have a good year. All right, members, we got a few things we're going to do today. The first thing will be a bill, and we'll get to that in a minute. And then we have two reports that the department has put out since we've last met, or at least had a chance to look at them. And so we're going to go over them on cemeteries and learn a little bit about Medicare, Medicaid, and how that might play into our veterans' homes for financing. So, but the first thing we're going to do, and again, we haven't decided. I assume there'll be an omnibus bill coming out of here of some way, shape, or form. So any bills we're hearing now will just lay over for possible inclusion. But I think it behooves us to get going on them as soon as we can, probably starting next week now that the budgets are out. I think the departments will be ready to go. I'm meeting with the governor's office and others this week, but we should be able to start on that next week and digging through those budgets and understanding what we need to do. But right now, I will move House File 2916 before the committee and call up the testifiers as we start here. Members, what this is a County Veterans Service Officers kind of rewrite. If you remember a couple of years ago, we had some discussions on CVSOs. At the time, we set up a task force that has met the last couple of years, actually. And over at the Department of Veterans Affairs, the department was there. The CVSOs, both rural and metro, were there. We had service organizations on that task force, legislators, myself, and Senator Ropes, Representative Smith, and Han, I think, was the, so we had four legislators on it. And basically what you're seeing in front of you is a rewrite of those statutes. And so I'm carrying that on their behalf and as a member of the task force. But certainly this is the legislature, and they need to explain what's going on here, why it's going on, and then certainly it'll be before the committee for questions and or tweaks. So however you two want to proceed, we'll get going and introduce yourself for the tape, and we'll start there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jim Golgart. I am the president of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers.
Yeah, I'll just start off. You might have noticed Joe Voss from the Office of Legislative Auditors is here with us, and that's really what started this whole process. There was a legislative audit done of the CVSO system, and there were some things that were pointed out that possibly could be improved upon, especially the statutes. So that's what this bill really is addressing, trying to clarify the ambiguity that's found within the current statutes. A lot of them were written back in the 40s. A lot's changed since then. So we really wanted to just take a comprehensive look at the current statutes that govern county veteran service officers, make sure that they're up to date, make sure that they're clear, make sure that it's providing the type of resources to them that the department should be providing to them. So that was the effort that we went through, and as Representative Junkie mentioned, we worked with the CVSOs, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Veteran Service Organizations were represented by Dean Ashman. So we had all the players at the table, and we really went through the statutes very carefully to make sure that we were delivering a good product that was going to serve our veteran community better in the future. And if you'd like, we can go through the entire bill and the language.
That's what we'd like.
Questions? You would like that?
Go through it section by section. I think it's important that we hear and understand what's in here.
Okay.
And why it's in here.
You know, on the first page, and I'm going to let President Goldgart discuss this one. Basically, what we did on this first page was just took out some existing language. And the reason we took it out is because there was really no longer a need for it to be in there. The counties have the authority to partner if they want to. So there could be one CVSO that represents more than one county if that's what they choose to do. And that's what the language was saying. We just clarified it a little bit, took some of the old language out, added some of the new language in. Doesn't really change anything. It just clarifies it a little bit.
And then maybe you can explain why Clay County was singled out in there. Now it's out. Give us some history. I mean, we can read what's under those crossouts, too, and we're kind of curious.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, that goes back from everything that we were able to determine on the committee. That goes back to when the original statute was written back in the 40s. And there was really no need for it as we reviewed that. There was no need to give an exception. My understanding of the exception was that at that time when the statute was presented and passed 60 years ago, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs was also helping the Clay County. They had an office out of the Fargo office, and they were helping the Clay County, and that's why Clay County was identified. But in working with the department, there was no need for Clay County to have that exception. And Mr. Pugliese said, it was just more than nothing more than a cleaning up of the language, changing a few words here and there, and making it be able to read smoother.
And to be clear, Clay County does have veteran service officer now.
Correct, they do.
Yeah. All right.
The other thing this does, Mr. Chair and members, is we added new language, are qualified for the assistant veteran service officers. So they're going to have the same qualifications as county veteran service officers, which we think is important.
Okay.
And that's where it takes us to qualifications, 197.601, qualifications of veteran service officers. We just cleaned this up a little bit more, too. In the past, you can see where we struck 4 and 5. It said that you had to have education and training for the duties of a veteran service officer and knowledge of the laws and regulations of that job prior to being hired. And it's virtually impossible to find a county veteran service to hire somebody into that position with all of those skills. Usually once you hire them, then we train you up and you achieve all those skills. So it really put us in a difficult position to look for somebody with those qualifications. 99% of the time, you're not going to find it. So we wanted to clarify that. So what we did by striking that, then we added the language below that ensures that within the 6 months after being hired, they are expected to receive all the training they need to be very proficient as a CVSO. So that's all that section took care of. Anything you want to add?
I would only add that in regards to the training, the association and the department are working hand in hand right now to expand our education program so that the service officers are getting more training. We have the National Association of County Veteran Service Officers coming to Minnesota here in June for our annual training. And through a grant from the department, we have every county service officer from the state of Minnesota and assistant going to that training. So we are working and gearing our training towards so that they are able to accomplish what the statute requires them to do.
It's very rigorous training, very good training that they go through. The next section, 197.605, we changed it from supervision. There was a big issue for many years with regards to what role the Department of Veterans Affairs really truly played when it comes to county veteran service officers. There was a lot of ambiguity with the language where it would talk about supervising and methods of operation and that the department was supposed to do some of these things. Yet, it's very clear that CVSOs are county employees, hired, fired, disciplined, paid by the counties. So we really have no authority as a department to tell a county employee how to do their job, what to do, discipline them if we think they deserve it. So we really wanted to clarify that and make it more about the department being a resource for these counties. Not that we have oversight over them, we're going to put our thumb on them, we're going to tell them how to do their job. They know how to do their job. They have bosses in the counties to tell them how to do their job. We want to make sure that we provide the resources necessary to them so that they can be as exceptional as possible. And what we're going to do is work very closely with the association as well as with the Minnesota Association of Counties in developing a list of those resources that we as a department can provide to the counties when they want them. And that can go, right now we provide a lot of resources to them. We sit on the selection boards, we participate in the hiring of new CVSOs. When there's a gap, a CVSO either retires or leaves for a different position, a lot of times they'll call us in to help provide coverage for that office. So there's a lot of, we'll do office audits, so there's a lot of things we're already providing. We want to formalize that, make sure that all the county commissioners, CVSOs, administrators understand the department's there for us when we need them, and here's what they can bring to the table for us. So we're really going to try to put together a very comprehensive list so we can offer as much support to them as we can.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, we also had Commissioner Tom Warpka from Faribault County who was on the committee. And he was definitely in agreements with that, stated that because of the CVSOs are in a unique position, that we are county employees, he also felt that we still needed the department as a resource, not as a supervisor, but as the resource. And I think that will continue to work. We have worked with the Association of Minnesota Counties to determine what is going to go into that resource.
On the next page under Subdivision 2, use of agencies to present claims, really just clarified a little bit. It's no longer the Department of Veterans Administration, it's Department of Veterans Affairs. So really just clarified a few things. Once again, added the Assistant Veteran Service Officer in there. Underneath that, Subdivision 3 rules, we don't govern them. We're not supervising them. We don't have oversight over them. So we really didn't feel that we needed the ability to create rules to govern them. So we took that whole area out. Didn't touch anything with certification, but I'll comment on certification. Certification of CVSOs is not required for employment, but it is required for them if they want to participate in the grant opportunities that we offer. And we have had 100% certification of the CVSOs for many years. And the certification process is a pretty good process. It's pretty beefed up. It certainly requires quite a bit of them, certainly the training. And we're going to continue to work with the CVSOs to continue to modify the certification process as we go along.
So members, I think that's one of the key things that in order to get state resources, they do have to be certified and approved by the department. And so that's one of the hooks, if you will, that they have on them yet over the county employees.
Mr. Chair, another thing that we did with certification, if you remember, we tied in reporting. So we're going to, while we didn't put it into statute any reporting that they have to provide, we're going to, as a department, tie a certain amount of reporting that we've agreed upon through the work group to certification. So in order for CVSOs to be certified also, they're going to have to provide a basic amount of reporting to their county commissioners, administrator, and at the end of the year, we're going to get at the Department of Veterans Affairs, we're going to put together and include it in our annual report, their activities.
Can either one of you talk briefly about how do you get certified if you're hired and what's required of that?
The certification right now, Mr. Chair, is in a review and we're looking at changing it a little bit, but it used to be that we had to go through the CVSO basic training as presented by the department and then receive X number of hours of continuing education units throughout the year. In what we're in the process of doing now is because of all of the CVSOs in the state of Minnesota will attend a national training. They will be accredited with the National Association of County Veteran Service Officers. In order to maintain their accreditation with the national, they must maintain 16 hours of continuing education each year. So what the department and our association, we have a certification committee. We are working on gearing that training throughout the year to accomplish the 16 hours. and for instance, we have two trainings throughout the year in Minnesota. In April, we have our spring conference where the department puts that on. What we've done is we split those 16 hours, so the department now will provide 8 hours in the spring, and then the association has our fall conference in September. We will provide the other 8 hours. There will also be other opportunities, whether it be the basic CVSO course, if an individual has been working for 10 or 15 years and wants to go back just to refresh, they can do that. They have an advanced CVSO refresher course to give them other opportunities. And there will be other opportunities throughout the year to make sure that all the CVSOs get the 16 hours.
It's a pretty rigorous week-long of training that they go through their national organization. We felt that was probably the best training that we could provide them, and it already existed, so why recreate the wheel? And we were able to bring them, the national organization, to town this year using some of the CVSO grant money, so that every CVSO will be able to go through that training here locally, so we don't have to send them anywhere and spend more money. And once they go through that process, then they just have to keep up, as President Golgart said, with the 16 continuing education credits each year, and that should be very manageable.
And for new hires, there are other opportunities for them throughout the year to go to other states. The national goes to other states. They're contracting with other states to come in and provide that training. It just so happens the state of Minnesota, this is our annual conference, so this is where it started 20 years ago. We're coming back here for the anniversary. The state of Iowa has now required all of the CVSOs to be accredited with any CVSO, and we're going along a similar line with the certification with the department.
The next section, 197.606, classed as county employees, you know, that also put the department in a difficult position. And as I mentioned earlier, they're county employees under the exclusive jurisdiction of the counties. So we really just wanted to strike that language in this section that really put us in an awkward position of providing some of that oversight. So we just clarified that they work for the counties and they're under that exclusive jurisdiction of the counties. Section 5, the only thing we added was new language so that when we develop these education programs, we're working closely with our partners, the CVSOs. So we just added that language in there. Section 6, once again, just made sure we added the assistant county veteran service officers in there. We want them to have the same qualifications. And then on the back, what we had to do, because there might be an assistant county veteran service officer out there right now that maybe isn't a veteran. So what we wanted to do is give them some time to get up to speed. We don't want to say immediately you have to go ahead and fix this problem. If you have an assistant CVSO that's not a veteran, you got to fire them and hire one. So we're giving them, let's see, how long are we giving them?
Three years
to come into compliance with that. And hopefully that will be manageable. We all felt through the work group that was appropriate and should be manageable for a county to accomplish. And we felt it was very important for that assistant CVSO also, as I mentioned, because a lot of times the CVSO is out there in the community, they're very busy, they're doing outreach. That assistance back in that office, we really felt it important that they have all the same skill sets as the county veteran service officer.
All right.
And that's our presentation, Mr. Chair.
That's the bill. Questions? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Golgart, and Commissioner Puglisi. I'm looking at the qualifications for the officers.
Tell us what page you're on.
It's on page 2, lines 213 to 219. First question I got is, who pays for the training? Does the county pay for it, or does the department pay for it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, the department training that we provide, we pay for. So we do a spring conference. We pick up the tab. Our basic boot camp that we provide CVSOs, we pick up the tab. Any training we provide, we pay for. The fall conference that the county veteran service officers provide, the association pays for. So there's no money coming from the outside for any of this training. We all do it from within.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, if you get 6 months in here, time frame they need to get trained. If they can't do that in state, and they have to go out state, as you mentioned, then who pays for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, that would be up to the county In particular, I can use my county as, for instance, I have a convention or training budget that I have each year that I go to my county. So the counties are aware that they have the training budget, and we talked with Commissioner Warmka, and he's aware that the laws and the rules within the Department of Veterans Affairs changes yearly, monthly, daily, sometimes. So they are well aware that they have to do the training. For instance, the fall conference, that training is all provided by the association, but the county has to send that employee and has to pay for that employee to go there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, we provide ongoing training through our claims office also, which is local over at the Henry Whipple Federal Building. So that goes on a regular basis, so they can certainly participate in that locally and not have to leave state. They might have to leave state to go to the NAC VSO training so that they can get their certification at some point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just concerned about the six-month time frame, if that's certainly we're going to hear from local units of governments about the cost of those folks and us at the state reducing those resources in a lot of cases to them. So that was just a concern I had. I wanted to make sure I understood it.
Make sure Representative Magnus knows, is there any change in this at all or what, you know? So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, most of the county veteran service officers I know that are hired, they are hired and put on a 12-month probation. So they have a 12-month probationary period that they have before the county actually confirms their appointment as a CVSO. If you're not comfortable with the 6 month, the 12 month might be a way to amend that to where it gives them a little bit extra time and that they fall within their 12 month of initial appointment.
And Mr. Chair, please. Representative Magnus, too, you know, Reggie Worlds, who's our senior director on program services, mentioned also that when a new hire comes on board, we quickly send our claims office staff and our benefits office staff out to the county for several days, sometimes a week, to spend with them. So that's no expense at all, just to get them up to speed, make sure that they're comfortable, they know who to call with questions, give them the basics. And then, as I said, they're always welcome to come down to the federal building for a few days and take advantage of the training we provide down there. Now, there would be a cost with that because they have to, sometimes if they live far, they might have to spend the night. But it would be, you know, not a lot of money. But we go out there immediately, which I forgot to mention, which is another big service that we provide that really helps get them off to the right start.
Okay. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this question is probably outside the scope of this bill, but one of the things that I'd like Mr. Goldgart maybe to render an opinion or think about, a lot of our counties are talking about, you know, combining services or regionalizing services and so forth, and I was talking with my local veteran service officer in McLeod County about the idea of having an office in the local armory. And would that be feasible? Would it be practical? And would it serve veterans in a greater or lesser fashion than if they have an office in the county facility?
Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, I would offer the opinion that I would not believe that would be appropriate because not every community has a armory in their area. And for instance, the closest armory to me is in LeSueur County is in St. Peter. Therefore, my constituents, veterans in LeSueur County, would have to go all the way to St. Peter. There are other counties that they may not even have an armory within their county. I believe, and the association would take the stand, that every county needs to have that county service officer, and the best place for them is at the county seat where everything else is being handled. I know that there is one county, Polk and Stevens County, that is using dual services. The service officer serves both counties, and he stretches himself. He really does. If you look at trying to regionalize, it's going to be very, very difficult. If you go from one end of one county to the other end of the other county, you could talk 50 to 75, 100 miles that individual, that CVSO may have to travel, or that veteran and his family may have to travel to receive the services. So I believe, and I believe the stance of the association would be that we would support all of the CVSOs in the particular counties at the county seat. Keeping that in mind, we do go out, and that is part of our outreach. We are out in the communities, out with the National Guard. We just had 12 county veteran service officers along with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Higher Education, the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and the Employment Services. We had them out at Fort Lewis, Washington, greeting 1,200 National Guard members to come back under the reintegration, the Yellow Ribbon campaign. What that also does now is that we reached out and we touched every single soldier that came back and talked to them about their benefits. Now, as they're back in Minnesota with the 30, the 60, and the 90-day drills, we will have a representative from not only the CVSO Association, but also higher education, revenue, and the employment services. So we are out there in the communities. We are doing the outreach.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, you know, I think you might have been asking, in addition to our current county veteran service officer system, having somebody maybe embedded in those armories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more is always better. But we're already, as you know, Jim was mentioning, we're already invited into the armories quite a bit. We're working very closely with our guard. The Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, you know, effort is, you know, working quite well. We participate in the 30, 60, 90 day, you know, programs as well. So I don't know that it would help all that much. You know, it would be an additional staff person that we'd have to find and place in those armories. There's not always a lot of activity in those armories. And as I said, whenever they want us to come out, all they do is pick up the phone and say, hey, we have drill this weekend or something. We want you to come out, and we come out.
Okay. And just to follow up on that, Representative Szymanski and others, I think that is one of the concerns of the legislature in particular, but I know of the CVSOs too. Again, trying not to dictate what the counties do, but at the same token, CVSOs are money raisers for the county. And I think part of our challenge is educating county commissioners to understand that. And when you look at the number of veterans in a county versus how many CVSOs or assistants are in that county, we do see discrepancies across the state. And where there's a shortage of CVSOs, I mean, I'd love to reach out to a county and say, you need to hire someone else, because it will bring money. It brings federal money to your county. It virtually pays for that officer to be there. And even in a lot of counties, they're shared. There might only be a 50% CVSO in some of our smaller counties, even though they have a fairly large number of veterans. So that's one of the things we did discuss. I don't know how to go about that other than at this point, really, and the commissioners and AMC that were sitting there basically indicated, too, that you know, they're going to the AMC conferences, I believe, now. You're really reaching out to touch the commissioners and have them understand the value of that CVSO office, and I think that continues to be one of our challenges.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. You know, and we do participate with the County Veteran Service Officers at the AMC conferences. We've been asked to come forward and speak and address the audience regarding County Veteran Service Officers and how important they are within the counties and the tremendous bang for the buck that you get for them. I mean, they bring in millions upon millions of federal dollars into that community that gets spent right in that community, and it reduces the dependence of some of those veterans in that county on state programs, because we get them enrolled in all the VA health care, the federal programs. So it's a tremendous return on investment, and one of the biggest things we're trying to do for the counties is heighten that awareness, educate the county commissioners so that they fully understand the impact that a good CVSO can have in their community, and it definitely pays for itself 10 times over.
Okay, Representative Anderson, then Magnus.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Being these employees are now going to be classified strictly as county employees, is there any legal or union problems requiring that they be veterans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there was always that requirement that they be veterans, always existed. So I don't foresee any problems with the unions or anything.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't believe that any of the CVSOs, with the exception of possibly one county, Washington County, is a member of the union. Most of us are all department heads, so we are management, non-union. And it's just because of the structure. But every CVSO in the state of Minnesota right now is a veteran, and there is no doubt that we will support anything other than being a veteran to serve our veterans.
Representative Anderson.
But you mentioned something about a 3-year window for like an assistant to, does that mean there are some out there that may have to quit within 3 years then?
Yeah, what are we going to do with that? We don't want anyone to lose their job if they're good at it either.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a good point. As far as we can tell, there's not too many that are assistants that aren't veterans, but there are a few. And that does pose a problem in 3 years. What issues might arise as a result of that? I'm really not sure. I'm not that up to speed on labor law. I don't know how it would affect if the unions, you know, if it's in statute and it's now law, I guess it's they have to abide by it. Will they have some type of a grievance process? Possibly. I'm really not clear on that.
Representative Junkie and or Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, with the different counties, there are different classifications. So there may be some individuals that are working in particular, maybe in Hennepin or Ramsey County or Dakota County, that are not veterans. But their actual title is not an assistant county veteran service officer. So that's where each particular county is different in how they classify their particular assistants. They may be just a veterans claim representative. They may not be the actual assistant.
Or they may be some sort of support staff for
support phones staff.
And filing and paperwork, and they can be classified differently and still maintain their job.
Right. Correct.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, though, I will do some looking into that for you and get back to you with an answer as to how that might affect some of those employees.
Yeah, we don't want any surprises, or we don't want that assistant calling Representative Anderson from Pope County and asking him why he's voting his or her job out. So, all right. Other discussion on the bill. Again, members, I think it's probably long overdue that we looked at this, and I appreciate the 2 years that this task force put in. It was thoroughly discussed, I can assure you, and at times heated discussions or directed discussions in the committee. But basically, at the end of the day, I think what everyone wanted to do was make sure that this reflected the services our veterans needed and the best way to deliver and make sure that those services were available out there. And hopefully we've done that. But again, what we're going to do is lay this over. So if there are questions or things that come up in between time, certainly we won't surprise the department or the CVSOs with them. But if we see there's questions or people want to change anything when we put together a larger bill, we'll certainly make sure you're here for that discussion. Anyone else in the audience interested in testifying for or against this? Or any comments? All right. Seeing none, thank you. This bill 2916 will be laid over for possible inclusion or other action later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for your participation and leadership through the process, too. Thank you.
Okay. Cemeteries. We want to hear about cemeteries. Here comes our guy. Members, again, just before we get into it, you have a report in here. Remember, over the last couple of years, we've had discussions on cemeteries. There was one slated to go in northeast Minnesota in a state-owned park, and that ran into some problems. I guess we're curious on where that's at. And then certainly Representative Hamilton, Magnus, and others, there was talk of locating one in southwest Minnesota at some point in time, and we got to work on that, and I don't know that anything has grown out of that at this point definitively either. But maybe, again, we're inviting folks up here. Our director, I believe, from Little Falls is here today. You can introduce yourself, and we want to know about veteran cemeteries, where we're at and where we're maybe going in the state.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is David Swantek. I'm the cemetery director at our current State Veterans Cemetery located in Little Falls, just next to Camp Ripley. A little overview on what we've accomplished at that facility since it opened in 1994. Through the end of last fiscal year, we've provided burials for 3,149 veterans and their eligible spouses or dependents. During the last fiscal year, we provided 282 burials. 189 of those were veterans, 93 were spouses and dependents. I was over at the Senate last week, and General Shelito presented their annual report, and inside the cover was the picture of the four National Guard members who've been killed in 2009. And we buried one of these young men, Specialist Colley. And the last thing that his parents said to me that day when they left the cemetery was, "Take good care of my son." And that really brings home what it is that we're doing. He was an only child, and they were leaving their most prized possession in our hands that day. And it really speaks to what we do on a daily basis and something that we're very proud to be able to offer to families in Minnesota. In 2008, Senator Vickerman's committee asked me to, or asked us to provide a some type of report to look at the potential for any cemeteries in the southern part of the state. I believe that was in response to some talk that had come out of the governor's office about the facility that was proposed in northeast Minnesota around Duluth. So we sat down and drafted a report internally that looked at what the potential might be for southern Minnesota. The first thing that I did, according to the National Cemetery Administration, is they define an unserved veteran as far as burial is concerned to be a veteran who resides further than 75 miles from either a national or a state veteran cemetery. So I took the map and created some 75-mile radiuses around Fort Snelling National Cemetery here in the Twin Cities.
Members, if you look at your report, it's on page 3, I believe, of that report, the map he's referring to.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Exhibit 1 on page 3. And then Little Falls, and then, of course, the proposed area in the Duluth area in northeast Minnesota. And I believe your copy is black and white, but essentially the white counties that are remaining there fall outside of that 75-mile radius. I didn't split a county, so if the line touched the county, I considered them to be served.
Mr. Swantek, can you tell me how it plays in? Are there cemeteries across the border? You know, does Sioux Falls have a cemetery, or does I mean, I'm just wondering what's beyond the borders of Minnesota if we, or consequently, also does the, for example, the Minneapolis cemetery, does that, do we have Wisconsin people that come and we bury there for them, or, you know?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, as far as cemeteries outside the state, nothing in South Dakota. There is a cemetery in North Dakota near Mandan, so that's quite a ways away. And then in Iowa, there's something that just opened in Des Moines, which would be outside of the area that we're looking at. Wisconsin does have a state veteran cemetery, three of them, in fact. The only one that really comes into play here is in Spooner, Wisconsin, which has an impact on the numbers in the Duluth area. When I did the report, I'm kind of taking two positions, and one is how the National Cemetery Administration looks at this. Obviously, they don't look at state borders when they're determining where to locate these facilities, but in my report, you know, as a state government, I thought it would be, you know, the right thing to do to look at what the numbers are for our citizens. And so the white county shown in both the southern part of the state and also in the northwest part of the state, there are no other state cemeteries or national cemeteries that would serve those counties. Being that the report was asked for the southern part of the state, I then, if you go to Exhibit 2 and 3, I broke the region down into a southwest and a southeast region. And based on demographic information that was available to me from the National Cemetery Administration, or more appropriately, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, as of 2010, the estimates for unserved veterans, which would be the grade areas on Exhibits 2 and 3, in southwest Minnesota, I calculated to be just over 18,000 veterans. In southeast Minnesota, I calculated to be just over 14,000 veterans. Again, I didn't divide counties. If a line from the existing cemeteries touched a county, I didn't count it. For example, Renville's a good example of that, right next to Redwood County, yet it's not counted. I just was trying to make a safe estimate to determine what the National Cemeteries Administration's demographics may or may not show for these areas. So So that shows the unserved area in a 75-mile radius. Further digging into what the veteran populations that may be served in those areas, I reduced the target areas down to a 50-mile radius. In Little Falls, since our operation began in 1994, statistically, we really are doing most of our burials from a 50-mile radius. Once a family lives further than 50 miles away, typically they're going to choose burial in a local cemetery, church, city, what have you. We kind of break that norm a little bit in Little Falls because there's a lot of veterans that have a connection to Camp Ripley. Some of these folks have spent years of their life on summer drills and weekends up in that area. And we break that norm a little bit, but statistically it does hold true that 50 miles is kind of our service area. So I wanted to look at the two ways of what we may offer as a state in those areas. So taking as a target area in Redwood Falls, I moved that 50-mile circle around several locations in southwest Minnesota and determining, where does that 50-mile radius grab the largest number of veterans in that populated area. Then I went from Marshall to Windham to all over. Redwood Falls was actually one of the last places that I looked, and when I put that 50-mile circle on the map, it really jumped out because the 14 counties that circle touches, all 14 county seats fall within that 50-mile radius. So it became quite apparent to me that was kind of the bullseye that we should be working off of, and doing a calculation, even though counties like Kandy, Ojai, and McLeod, Sibley are touched with the ring of Fort Snelling and Little Falls, a facility in the Redwood County area, or in particular the Redwood Falls area, would most likely be the location where they would choose. It's within that 50-mile range, and I estimated that almost 23,000 veterans would be served within that 50-mile ring of Redwood Falls. And likewise in southeast Minnesota, around the Stewartville area is where my report kind of centered on. That showed actually almost 29,000 veterans served in the counties within a 50-mile ring of that area. Again, in the eyes of the National Cemetery Administration, most of the residents of the Rochester area, Olmsted County, they probably are considered to be served by a cemetery, but I thought it was important to show what we may offer as a state facility. So based on that information, the southeast and the southwest area appeared to have significant enough veteran populations to get support for a grant from the National Cemetery Administration. And Exhibit 6, the final exhibit, again in the eyes of NCA, they'll count residents, veterans that fall out of state, and so that area in particular picks up a fair number of counties in Iowa and also reaches into La Crosse, Wisconsin, and so the potential numbers through the eyes of NCA would be fairly significant in that area, totaling almost 39,000 veterans. But keep in mind only 14,000 of those are unserved Minnesota residents. Why we chose to look at the Duluth area first, every 3 years we go through a review process, a triennial review process with the National Cemetery Administration. They send a representative from the grants office, typically the current director at Fort Snelling National Cemetery, and then also a resident engineer out of the Mizzen office, which is kind of the regional center for the National Cemetery Administration. In our case, that individual comes out of Indianapolis, Indiana. And they come out to the cemetery, and they walk the property. They look at our facilities and ask us questions about our operation. They really look into the administration of the cemetery, as well as the upkeep of the grounds, you know, what the appearance of the cemetery is. Are your headstones neat and orderly in fashion? Or is your turf healthy? Are your trees healthy? What's the condition of your facilities, your roads? They really dig into a lot of things. And during that last triennial review, which is now almost 3 years ago, which we, I should say one thing we're proud of, is when the report came back from that report, there was a comment issued with that. And at the time, the director of the grants program said undoubtedly it was the finest evaluation that had ever been given to a state veteran cemetery in the United States. So we're very proud of the work, again, that we're doing up there. But anyway, we had a discussion with them that day about, you know, is there any opportunities, you know, population-wise in other parts of our state that may support a cemetery. At that time, we had not conducted any research like this, and they came out and said, you know, the Duluth area, St. Louis County, obviously a very large veteran population. And based on that discussion that day, the Northeast area kind of became the focus of you know, that search. And the governor announced that as one of his initiatives a few years ago to secure property for that that area. And with that, it became the focus at the time for the one additional proposed cemetery in the state. And then last year, based on the study that I'd presented over at the Senate, Senator Frederickson proposed an appropriation in the bonding bill to include another cemetery in Redwood County. And, of course, we were successful in getting some money for those two projects. And so the, you know, our focus kind of shifted from one cemetery in northeast Minnesota to two potential cemeteries, adding the area in southwest Minnesota. We've submitted pre-applications to the National Cemetery Administration for both these projects. Basically, what that does is it just establishes a line of communication with the federal government and the state that we're interested in the project. They go out and further define demographics. They do in-house another study of the kind of the region that we propose, and then they rank those projects. The way the grant program works is 100% of the funding for construction of the facility is through a grant from the National Cemetery Administration. The state's responsibility is to front the money for design of any proposed project. We certify that those dollars are available to us to spend for design, which we were able to do because of the appropriation that was passed last year for these projects. And then the NCA ranks the projects according to underserved veteran population. So both of these projects are in the hopper out there. We have money that we've been able to certify as available for design of these projects, and therefore we can move them forward. The design dollars ultimately are also reimbursed. So when we move forward with a design, that gets submitted for final review to NCA in the form of construction documents. They approve those documents to be placed out on the street for bid. Once the bids are received and a low bid is approved, that amount plus whatever the state's expended for design of that property becomes the basis of the grant award. So at that time, 100% of the design dollars are refunded back to the state, and then the grant funds the construction. So it's different than like a veterans home project in that it's 100%, which is a, you know, it's really a turnkey operation for the state. And then of course the state has a responsibility to operate the cemetery. That's an assurance that the state provides to the National Cemetery Administration that they will operate the cemetery according to national shrine standards, and that's where the triennial review process comes in. They come in every 3 years to make sure that the state is following through on that assurance.
David, could you just real quickly share what you think the tails of a cemetery would cost?
Absolutely. Currently, we're in Little Falls. All of these facilities appear that they would be similar in scope as far as the operation goes, as far as the number of burials on an annual basis, the staffing levels that would be required at each cemetery. And currently, it takes just under $500,000 to operate on an annual basis in Little Falls. So I think we could safely estimate that, you know, for each of these additional cemeteries that would open, you know, we'd be in that $400,000 to $500,000 a year range for staff and operating expenses. Getting back to the grant, the application, as expected when we submitted these pre-applications, the fiscal year 10, which is federal fiscal year 10, priority list of pending state and tribal government cemetery construction grant pre-applications has been issued and signed by Secretary Shinseki, and I believe that's in your packet. And as you'll see, the two projects in Minnesota ranked 14 and 15 respectively on that list. A little background on the different kind of indication or descriptions. The first 10 projects on this list are for expansion or improvement projects, typically smaller in nature, at existing or open state veteran cemeteries. When you get to the grant applications that are for the establishment of new cemeteries, which are your major appropriation of grant dollars, we actually rank currently number 4 and 5 on that list for those projects. So out of the 60 projects that are on the list, you know, we're in a real nice position, and that's, you know, a lot of that can be attributed to the support from the legislature for those design dollars and that appropriation last year. It allows us to compete at this high level. If you go to the second page of that list, starting at project number 37, essentially through project 56, those are all for the establishment of new cemeteries, and some of which, Flagstaff, Arizona, for example, showing an underserved veteran population of nearly 39,000 people. You know, certainly the population's there for a project like that, but their state legislature's not appropriated any design dollars, so they can't compete for funding. So, you know, with your support last year and in the past, you know, we're able to compete with other states for funding. And so the key really is to find a site. And that's one other thing that the National Cemetery Administration does not do. They will not, we cannot use grant dollars to purchase property. The state has to either secure property through a donation, existing state-owned property, or purchase property. Last year, the language in the appropriation bill required, there was an appropriation of up to $500,000 available for us to purchase property. I did require that we seek donations of property and look at other potential state-owned property before we got into an acquisition phase. The first thing that we did was we reached out to the County Veterans Service office in Redwood County and worked with them to make sure that we got that information out to all the County Veterans Service the Veterans Service organizations in the county, so they could start, you know, talking about this. That it, you know, it appeared that this could be a reality. That we were looking for any person that may be willing to donate 60 to 120 acres for such a facility. And we kind of, you know, let that word travel throughout Redwood County through that means. One thing we also did was we reached out to the DNR. We've been working with the DNR for the last couple years up in the northeast part of the state to look for state-owned property. And I believe in your packet there is a letter from a regional director of the DNR, Mr. Matsuka, that basically indicates that they were unable to identify any sites in Redwood County that would satisfy our needs. What we're finding is that, of course, southwest Minnesota, predominantly in agriculture, is much different than northeast Minnesota, all kinds of tax forfeit and state-owned property in the northeast part of the state that we're, you know, we've spent the last couple years looking for sites up there on something that would be appropriate. So the DNR search didn't, unfortunately, didn't find anything for us in Redwood County. We also ran some local press releases in the newspaper, kind of outlining what our needs would be. And we set a deadline of September 30th, 2009, to receive any proposals for donated property. We did receive one offer of a donation. It was in the Wabasso area, southwest Minnesota. I went down in May and took a look at the property, and we ran there's a web-based soil analysis tool that the Department of Agriculture has that we can identify a parcel of property, and it returns information basically from the Soil Conservation Office, and we can look at things like soil types and water tables and that type of thing. And when we identified the property that had been proposed as a donation, it immediately the map, they it comes up with maps and it colors them, you know, based on what you're trying to do for development, and the area came up pretty much all red in color, which is not a good thing when that happens on that particular program. And so we dug into it and looked at why that was, and essentially it was a very high water table in the area. On my visual inspection of the property, there was a major irrigation canal that basically ran right through it, which divided it into two portions. It just wasn't conducive to what our needs would be. So, again, I believe there's a copy. We sent a letter and thanked the gentleman for his generous offer. Land value down in that part of the state is expensive, valuable property. And for him to step forward and offer a donation of, I believe his property was around 80 acres of something that's valued at almost $5,000 an acre, that's a pretty significant gesture that he laid out for us. So we thanked him for that. I included the report from the United States Department of Agriculture, so he had something to see what we used for that. And really brings us to today, and currently, we have identified five parcels of property in southwest Minnesota that are for sale. Ranges from, all of them, in fact, are properties that are not on the market for sale. It's individuals that are more or less interested in this project and are, you know, interested in offering up property that they have available, unfortunately not for donation, for sale. You know, there may be opportunities to negotiate a reduced value in their price. So, you know, they may donate a portion of the value of their land for the project. But, you know, we're still kind of working through that process and evaluating the sites. One of the five sites we've absolutely had to eliminate from consideration based on some preliminary research that our architectural and engineering team came up with the potentially deal breakers on the property. Kind of to back up, we did execute a contract with the architectural and engineering team in January. Boonestro Engineering is a local Minnesota firm. We had, I believe, four proposals from firms in Minnesota for the project for design of both of these proposed projects. We're very excited to be working with this firm. They recently have just finished the $25 million expansion project at Fort Snelling. This team is versed in what the National Cemetery Administration thinks a cemetery should be, how they should be laid out, some of the challenges that are presented in the review process with the federal government. We're excited to have them be a local firm and be excited about working for the state for design of these two projects. So with them under contract, We're now able to utilize them for site analysis for some of these properties that we're looking at, which gives us a team of engineers and designers that can help us. At the end of the day, I'm just a cemetery director. I've been doing this for a long time and been through several 3 grant projects in Little Falls, but there's a lot of complexities that are involved in building a cemetery this size, and so having them help us with these is going to be very valuable for us. Just in closing, the pre-application grant request that we've submitted, we have to kind of do a preliminary budget on that. And for the Redwood County project, we've submitted an application for $7.9 million for that project, and the Duluth area project is a pre-application for $8.35 million. So, combined, these are significant projects with significant dollar amounts that are available to us. As again, 100% of that money comes through the grant. So we're out looking for sites because that really is the one missing piece that we have in moving these projects forward. With that, right. I'd be happy to take questions.
Yeah, I have a question. First of all, thank you. That was very thorough. I learned way more about cemeteries than I thought I would today, and we're probably going to be short on time for you, Deputy Commissioner, but we have session at noon, but that's okay. I want to go back to the DNR. I still find it very hard to believe. I wonder how involved they were with you and what we can do to maybe help out with that. Off the top of my head, and maybe narrowing it to Redwood County and not the edges of Redwood County, or I think there's some other areas to look at too. One that comes to mind, and again, because I travel with the bonding committee, did we ever look at, what is it, Fort Ridgely down there? I mean, we actually have old fort land down there on the river. I think it's just outside of Redwood County. It's in Renville County, I believe, but it's really, really close to Redwood Falls. It's not far away. I mean, have we looked and explored some of that? We do have state-owned land in the area that, I even think locating a cemetery at a fort is kind of an intriguing process to think about. And because it is expensive land, as we all know, on the Ag Committee, if you want to go out and buy down there, it's going to be very difficult to get that through a bonding committee at this point in time. And then I also start thinking about all our reinvest in Minnesota lands. Well, I know there's rules and regulations on that. Certainly, we're the rulemakers and the regulators, and if we can, capture one of those parcels with one of those landowners, I just wonder how comprehensive that map was of state or government-owned or controlled land was down there, or if the DNR just kind of looked and said, well, we really don't have anything. It's not northeast Minnesota. So,
sure, Mr. Chairman. We've worked closely with Deputy Commissioner Martinson from the DNR in our search in both these locations. We gave them criteria kind of based on the National Cemetery, again, their standards for site selection. It has to be on a major highway size-wise. There were things down there that were possibilities on gravel roads. And as you say, Mr. Chair, a lot of restrictions on wildlife management areas and scientific natural areas and things that, from our understanding and our discussions with them, really appeared in those discussions to be deal breakers for some of those sites that may or may not be available. I think they had a good understanding of what it was we were looking for. Redwood County was the focus, in the language, that's what it said. And, of course, we didn't ask them to look outside that area. So,
And perhaps this committee will make that request, and we'll try and get some more information the next month here or so we can maybe understand, is there something just on the perimeter of that might work? I think Magnus might have some land he'll donate down there, too, don't you? You got a family farm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, what we can do is we can ask DNR to take a look outside of Redwood, and maybe we can identify something and then maybe amend the language to include that area.
And just real quickly, did we get through? I know there were some problems with that initial site up in the Northeast. Did we find another site?
Mr. Chairman, we are still looking for a site in northeast Minnesota as well. There were problems with the original site on the southern edge of Jay Cook State Park. We had to...
Maybe with our help, we can help engage DNR and other folks again to maybe step this up so we can get going. We've got federal applications waiting, and I'm finding it troubling that that we're not moving ahead. Or all the state and the government-owned land we have, and county-owned and city-owned. I mean, we got to look beyond... you know, our ownership, too, as a state. I think there's federal, county, and city land out there that's owned, too, and I don't know that we've really dipped into that like we should, and we certainly can find those parcels with tax records and other things. So, and then my last question, you mentioned Stuartville. Is there any notion or desire to start that process? Representative Welty, that's where you're from, and it looks like a big need down there, too. Are you willing or able, or what's your thoughts on that? I'm sure working with Representative Welty and the folks in Southeast, I can't believe they wouldn't be interested in further discussions on that.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. In fact, we received a call in November from the county commissioners in Fillmore County. And we went down and gave a deputy commissioner, myself, went down and gave a presentation to their county commissioners, and they're very interested. You know, these are big projects. They're something that is a nice facility to have in your backyard, and 100% federally funded as far as construction goes is a nice thing. So there's talk down in southeast Minnesota, particularly Fillmore County, so that's something that we're...
And members, as we move forward, represent well to you in particular, maybe we can develop some language that goes in our bill to give some direction and start that process moving. So any other questions, members? I think we have some work to do on this. I'm glad you were here today. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment to the members here. Obviously, in my official capacity, I spend a lot of time out Little Falls area cemetery, and also personally because my father-in-law was one of those 183 veterans that was interred there last year. And we are in a position here to have, as the study actually showed, the finest facility around, and I just want to say for those who haven't been there, that study was right. These guys are doing it right, and whatever help we can give them, as you said here, I think that's incumbent upon us to do that. So we want to thank you for the job you're doing. It's over and above what would be necessary, and the families of the people there greatly appreciate that.
Other questions on the cemeteries? Representative Brown.
I just had a question about what you can and cannot do with the donations. You were talking about a donation of land where the water table was too high and the cost per acre was $5,000 an acre. Night, are you able to accept that donation and then sell the property? And okay,
Mr. Chair, members, I would just want to mention that Senator Ropes is very interested in the southeast area. She's looking to propose some language, so Representative Welty might want to discuss that with her, maybe co-author or introduce or something.
Okay, anything else? All right, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Are you going to be really mad at me if I put you on first at our next veterans thing? I gave you an hour and a half to sit here and relax. You didn't have the phones ringing, and I apologize to Deputy Commissioner Acevedo, but we do have, I think we need to give this maybe a good half hour or better to understand how this interfaces with our homes, and it's just not fair, I don't think, to start here, get into it, and then have to quickly leave and bring you back again to pick up. So if you don't mind, I apologize. On it's my fault, but this was good information that we needed to do, too. And so, members, we have what's up tomorrow? Get your microphone in front of you. Don't tell me. Tell them.
Mr. Chair, members, we have farmer lender mediation. The Rural Finance Authority is coming in to give a report, and I think we're going to add on the results of the Department of Ag's listening sessions that they conducted last summer.
So again, if you remember, we passed our extension of the farmer lender mediation last year, but we promised Farm Credit Services and the bankers and the other folks that we'd have them back, particularly to discuss that de minimis level when they kick in and any other changes that we might see going forward, if any. But I think we promised them a day, and tomorrow's their day. So I know we're going to have some presentations on that. And then hopefully next week, along with some veterans reports, I know the Department of Veterans Affairs is ready to go on their budget, and I hope Department of Agriculture should be ready next week, too, so we'll probably have a couple budget days, and we'll include on the Veterans Day the Medicaid piece here that we're talking about. So, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Swantek, if you could come back down. Several of us were just discussing this. We're looking at that map, and we're just wondering why we would leave out northwestern Minnesota. If we're going to take a comprehensive look at this, why did we just look at the southern part of the state and not the far northwest?
Yep.
Because I was looking at the numbers and what's being proposed in other states such as South Dakota, and they're serving a very small population, but they still have proposals in. And if we're going to do a comprehensive approach, then we really should do a comprehensive
approach. Would it make sense to look at northwest as long as we're instructing you to go with a Crookston or East Grand Forks? Again, you said there's really nothing in North Dakota either, so you'd probably be serving across the border up there, too.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative. The Senate request was just to look at southern Minnesota. I did do this report in-house with data that's available, to me, so I'd be more than happy to take a quick peek at northwest. Obviously, there's a big white spot on that map up there, too, so we don't want to leave those.
If you do that, get us some numbers and just move your little circle around and see what you think might be best. But clearly, I think you're right. There's a need up there, too, and Eakin probably wants it in Twin Valley, but I don't know if that was part of the map or what it was. But we'll see what happens. We do have members up there, too, that are interested. So if you can get us that in the next week or so, if time allows, we'd appreciate that, either to the members or get it to our committee here, and we'll pass it out. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. We're adjourned. On to session.